Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this Easter Sunday edition of our English feature program. Coming up today, there's more in the Sunday Gospel than meets the eye. Jill Bevilacqua presents readings and reflections for this Easter Sunday celebration of our Lord's resurrection. And our regular guest Joan Lewis is back to share her insights into events here in the Vatican over Holy Week. We begin our programme with Jill Bevilacqua's selection of readings and reflections for the Sunday liturgy. There's more in the Sunday Gospel than meets the eye. Let's listen first of all to the words of the Gospel for Easter Sunday, read to us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Early in the morning, on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb. She saw that the stone had been moved away, so she ran off to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and told them, "The Lord has been taken from the tomb. We don't know where they have put him." At that, Peter and the other disciples started out on their way toward the tomb. They were running side by side, but then the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He did not enter, but bent down to peer in and saw the wrappings lying on the ground. Presently, Simon Peter came along behind him and entered the tomb. He observed the wrappings on the ground and saw the piece of cloth which had covered the head, not lying with the wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the disciple who had arrived first at the tomb went in. He saw and believed. Remember, as yet, they did not understand the scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead.
When Jesus was buried on the evening of Good Friday, there was not only among his friends an atmosphere of sadness and despondency, but also a sense of urgency. For it was the vigil of the Sabbath, known as the Day of Preparation. And as a biblical scholar writes,
that particular Sabbath was especially festive because it coincided with the Passover. The obligation to rest was one of the most binding and began with the appearance of the first stars of the vigil.
This is confirmed by what Luke writes.
It was preparation day, and the Sabbath was imminent. Meanwhile, the women who had come from Galilee with Jesus were following behind. They took note of the tomb and of the position of the body. Then they returned and prepared spices and ointments, and on the Sabbath day they rested, as the law required.
Whether they slept, though, is another matter. It must surely have been the longest Sabbath they ever remembered. And unknown to them, it was also the last Sabbath of all, to be lived in the old way, or at any rate with any real conviction. And at some point, as we may read,
the first day of the week, in memory of Jesus' resurrection, was named by Christians the Lord's Day, and the obligation of keeping it as a holy day was transferred to it from the Sabbath.
Wrote St. Jerome in the 4th century.
The Lord's Day, the day of the resurrection, the day of Christians, that is our day.
And St. Isidore in the 7th century wrote,
this day the Jews did not observe, but it was declared by the Christians in honour of the Lord's resurrection, and the celebration began from that time.
But for the holy women on that first Easter morning, this was all in the future. And the old Sabbath was barely over when, at the first sight of dawn, as Luke writes, they went to the tomb with the spices they had prepared. The embalming, however, was never to take place. Meanwhile, what had been going on during that historic Sabbath? Let's listen to this extract from an old homily for Holy Saturday, which is quoted in the 1992 Catechism.
Today there is a great silence on the earth, a great silence and solitude, a great silence because the King is sleeping. The earth is dismayed and is silent, because God made flesh has fallen asleep and has woken those who had been sleeping for centuries. He is going to look for the first father, like the lost sheep. He wants to go down to visit those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. God and his Son go to free from their sufferings Adam and Eve, who are in prison. I am your God, who have become your Son for you. Awake, you who sleep. In fact, I did not create you to remain a prisoner in hell. Arise from the dead. I am the life of the dead.
He descended into hell. The third day he rose again from the dead. In the section devoted to an explanation of the Apostles' Creed, the Catechism comments.
The descent of Christ into the underworld and his resurrection from the dead on the third day are professed in the same article of faith, because in his Easter he made life spring forth from the abyss of death.
Today we very rarely reflect on the descent into hell, perhaps because the word suffers from ambiguity, but also because of our modern distaste for all references to hell and devils. But, as one scholar writes, medieval men and women took the devil and his works more seriously. In their pageants and miracle plays, Christ's descent into hell was vividly represented. The harrowing of hell, as it was called, was based on a popular legend which had its origin in the apocryphal Gospel of Nicodemus, writes our scholar.
This legend is dramatized in all the English cycles, represented in sculpture and painted glass, and used again and again in the sermons.
A brilliant example of the harrowing of hell in stained glass can still be seen in the 15th century church of St. Mary the Virgin in Fairford, Gloucestershire. I was taken by a friend one summer day to this unique church, which has no fewer than 28 windows in stained glass portraying 1,000 figures. As the guidebook declares proudly, no other parish church in England has retained a complete set of late medieval glass. Window 6, divided into three parts, shows the deposition on the left, the entombment in the centre, and on the right, the harrowing. Here, as the guidebook explains,
Christ rescues Adam and Eve from hell and proclaims the good news to imprisoned souls. One soul, still impenitent, is seen behind red-hot bars.
And you can almost feel the heat. Although we use the word harrowing today as an adjective, meaning painful in the extreme, referring to an experience or even only something painful to watch, a dictionary will tell us that the verb to harrow was a 13th century word meaning to rob or despoil, and that it was used especially with reference to Christ's descent to hell to carry off the souls of righteous people. Back in the 9th century, these lines formed part of an Easter hymn by Rabanus Maurus, abbot of the famous monastery of Fulda in Germany.
Breathing out his soul, Christ entered the underworld, triumphant. He banished the shadows of death. The just he snatched away. The enemy he bound, giving heaven to the good, while evil men were left in their pains.
But by Easter morning, all this has been accomplished, and the scene shifts once again to earth, to the empty tomb. What happened next, and who came to the tomb at first light, is recounted in their different ways and with varying details by all four evangelists. But who saw the risen Jesus first? This was often asked us as children by our teacher of religion. It was, of course, a catch question. Although it's not mentioned in any of the Gospels, clearly the first person Jesus appeared to must have been his mother. To the evangelists, it would have seemed too obvious to need recording. Not so obvious would have been his appearance to other women. As for who went to the tomb with the spices, among a variety of names recorded, only one appears in all four Gospels, that of Mary Magdalene. And today's Gospel, that of John, chosen to be read on Easter Sunday in all 3 years of the liturgical cycle, gives prominence to that one name, Mary Magdalene. Reading on, we find that after they'd been to the tomb, Peter and John returned home. Mary Magdalene, however, who must have followed them back to the tomb, stayed behind, weeping. And it was then that she stooped to look into the tomb. There she saw two angels, who asked her why she was weeping. "They have taken my Lord away, and I don't know where they have put him." Something prompts her to turn round, and standing there is the risen Jesus. Taking him for the gardener, she asks if he has removed the body. But he speaks only one word, Mary. And as St. John writes,
"She knew him then. Rabuni," she said in Hebrew, "master."
What followed is told this way by poet George MacDonald.
He stands in haste, he cannot stop. Home to his God he fares. Go, tell my brothers I go up to my Father, mine and theirs. Run, Mary, lift thy heavenly voice, cry, cry and heed not how. Make all the new risen world rejoice, its first apostle, thou.
Apostle, from the Greek apostolos, is a messenger. Mary Magdalene is described in the liturgical calendar simply as disciple of the Lord. But because of the unique privilege of being the first to see the risen Lord, she's been called the Apostle of the Apostles. And in the revised calendar, her feast day on the 22nd of July has been classified as an obligatory memorial for the whole church. Not only John records that Magdalene saw the risen Jesus first, Mark, in his final summing up, writes,
"He, rising early the first day of the week, appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven devils."
Which, as Piero Bargellini points out, does not necessarily mean that she was a sinner. For the traditional image of Mary Magdalene is that of the penitent prostitute, usually identified as the woman who poured precious ointment over the feet of Jesus, causing Judas to exclaim, "Why wasn't this ointment sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" Modern scholarship shows us a different Magdalene. Freed of her demons, she follows Jesus from Galilee, together with other women, tends to his needs, stands at the foot of the cross, and is rewarded at the tomb by the vision of the risen Lord. And now let's listen to this Easter poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who in the opening verse invites us symbolically to imitate the woman in the Gospel and spare no expense in celebrating the risen Christ.
"Break the box and shed the nard. Stop not now to count the cost. Hither bring pearl, opal, sard. Reck not what the poor have lost. Upon Christ throw all away. Know ye, this is Easter Day. Build his church and deck his shrine, empty though it be on earth. Ye have kept your choicest wine, let it flow for heavenly mirth. Pluck the harp and breathe the horn, know ye not 'tis Easter morn? Gather gladness from the skies, take a lesson from the ground. Flowers do ope their heavenward eyes, and a springtime joy have found. Earth throws winter's robes away, decks herself for Easter Day. Beauty now for ashes wear, perfumes for the garb of woe, chaplets for dishevelled hair, dances for sad footsteps slow. Open wide your hearts that they let in joy this Easter Day. Seek God's house, in happy throng, crowded let his table be, mingle praises, prayer and song, singing to the Trinity. Henceforth, let your souls alway make each morn an Easter Day."
There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye was written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. And now our regular guest Joan Lewis is back to share her insights into events here in the Vatican over Holy Week, beginning with Palm Sunday celebrations in St. Peter's Square.
The very start of Holy Week, and, you know, I don't know how many of our listeners did happen to be in St. Peter's Square Sunday, but I mean, it was phenomenal. And as I was walking around and looking at people and in and out of the press office, because I wanted to kind of participate, if you will, in Mass as much as I could. But the numbers of people, they just kept pouring in from all the little side streets and then Via della Conciliazione. The Romans, of course, wanting to see their bishop, the Pope. And it's interesting, just as an aside, I don't know if you've become aware of this, Pope Francis refers to himself constantly as the Bishop of Rome. He does not refer to himself as, I think maybe once or twice he said successor of Peter, but as the Roman pontiff or any other title.
Very significant, so, both for the church here in Italy, the Catholic Church around the world, but also relations with other churches.
Exactly. But it's very, very interesting because I don't know if that's why so far Pope Francis has only spoken Italian. At all of the events, obviously we don't know about private, but at all of the public liturgies and other events, he's only spoken Italian. And I think what amazed a lot of people, just to go forward for a few days to the Wednesday general audience, his first, and exactly 1 month after Benedict said his last audience, I was just waiting for the Holy Father to begin the different language catecheses, and then at the end, he doesn't speak as many languages, as we are told, as John Paul and Benedict. However, I've been told, Cardinal Dolan told me he speaks English. He came up to Cardinal Dolan and the congregations, Cardinal Bergoglio, and he said in English to Dolan, they spoke. So here at the audience, you had only Italian. And it was the Monsignors from the Secretariat of State. I don't know if our listeners, you know, exactly know how this happens, but all the different languages, the greetings, the readings from the gospel, they are all said by language experts from the Secretariat of State.
And the English language expert was a regular guest on Vatican Radio, Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Yes, no, it was just wonderful. But the interesting thing is usually they'll say, and Holy Father present today, our groups from, and they'll name the groups from that country. And then the Holy Father will give a summary of his larger, longer catechesis in Italian, in English and Spanish and so forth. And so the Monsignore did it this week. And I think what surprised people more than anything else was that his native Spanish was also handled by a Monsignor. Now, I'm sure someday in the near future we're going to learn, because somebody's probably going to ask him, why Francis is speaking predominantly only, you know, in Italian. Is it linked to his calling himself the Bishop of Rome? In any event, it was an amazing event, and about 11 in the press office, Father Benedettini came in and said the police had given figures of about 250,000 people. But I want to tell you, they were still pouring in. And I put a lot of pictures on my blog of this, you know, human carpet that from Conciliazione to the Basilica.
Looking at the homily, he focused on three words, didn't he? The joy of being a Christian.
And the cross, the reason, of course, for this particular liturgical season. And Jesus, came down on earth to redeem us, and his throne was the wood of the cross. And then he spoke of youth and indicated quite clearly that anybody had any doubts, they were erased Sunday. He indicated he would see the young people in Rio de Janeiro in July for the World Youth Day, which Palm Sunday is, by the way, on a diocesan level throughout the world. And then Rio is just the international celebration. But the whole procession, the blessing of Palm, it's a very, very beautiful event. And it's one of those moments when you truly want to be there, because being there is different than not being there. But when watching it on television is, I have to say, very, very special. You can see the special palms. They have their own story. We could do a whole separate show on that. The beautiful palms, the procession, and the Pope is the final person to come, and then the blessing of the palms at the base of the obelisk, then the procession to the altar, and so forth. And interestingly enough, at the end of Mass, the Pope said the angels right there, and he did not go up to his study window.
Which took some people by surprise.
Well, took some people by surprise, but who it really took by surprise were those who were flowing into the square to see him at his window at noon. They hadn't come for Mass, or they were in the bed, whatever, but they came to see him at noon. And I know at a certain point I went out, and people were looking up at his window, and I said, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the Holy Father has already said, it was like 12:10 or something, has already said the Angelus. Oh, no, well, maybe he'll just open his window. And so people were waiting to see him appear at the window or at the loggia, which he did not do. But two workers, the loggia window did open at a certain point and the crowd gets silent. Then they cheer. And it was two workers who came out to take the tapestry off of the central loggia balcony. So no Holy Father. Now, I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but we did learn after... Holy Father went back in Sunday inside Vatican City, and then he visited the very beautiful Teutonic Cemetery, very beautiful, old, historic. That could be a separate show someday. And then returned to his residence at the Santa Marta, where he has been living since the conclave. And Monday, he's had Mass every morning in the chapel for different groups of Vatican employees. And Monday, we learned the Pope intends to live there.
Rather than moving into the restored...
The restored papal palace. You know, the apartments had been readied. They were sealed. Then they were opened in his presence. And then he walked in. He's reputed to have said, when he saw the papal apartments, you know, oh, my word, you could put 300 people here. And, of course, there's vast rooms. But, I mean, there's sitting rooms for audiences and so forth where he will go to those.
He is using some of those rooms,
yes,
isn't he?
Yes, for but
The sense is that he prefers a life in community with other people.
Well, the thing is, right now, what a lot of our listeners may not know is that Pope Francis Cardinal Bergoglio did not come to Rome with a priest assistant. Unlike others who've moved in, he doesn't have his, that we know of, a favorite order of nuns that could come in and do the cleaning and cooking and pray with him and be the household staff. So others have come to the papal apartments with a ready-made family. Cardinal Bergoglio lived on his own in an apartment. And
we've heard how he liked to cook and
looked
after himself pretty much.
Exactly. I'm going to talk to him someday and find out what his favorite dishes are, you know. But anyway, but going back to Holy Week, because obviously that is the focus of this week's show.
Let's look at some of those morning masses. As you say, he had Mass every morning, I believe, in the Casa Santa Marta for different groups of employees.
The Osservatore Romano, the very first group, and this really warmed my heart, was all of the gardeners and the people responsible for cleaning. In the Vatican, of course, a lot of whom, of course, were right there at Santa Marta during the conclave, and they took their vow of secrecy and so forth. So those Masses have been lovely. And then at the end of the Mass, the Pope goes to the back, very back pew on the left-hand side of this not very large chapel. And then there's smaller ones on different floors so that priests who live there, there's about 40 who live there all year round, and visiting priests can say Mass in the smaller chapels. But the Pope goes to the back pew, and then he meditates for a few minutes. And then everyone else meditates and reflects because they know that when he gets up, he will meet each one of them. So, you know, you do feel like you know this man.
Even after just a few weeks.
Oh, you do. And I have to say, in his homily, when he spoke of joy, I thought, Francis, that's what you're giving us. That's what you're bringing us. And if I can tell you one wonderful story, when I've forgotten what day it was. It might have been Wednesday. The Pope said the Mass in Santa Marta. Then he went to St. Peter's Basilica, which is 100 meters away, where the archpriest Cardinal Angelo Comastri had said Mass for a sizable group of Vatican employees. And so the Pope went over and he met the Cardinal. The Cardinal knew he was coming. And Cardinal Comastri told a story, and this is so beautiful, about John the 23rd, who seemed quite dismayed after his election. And speaking to his secretary, he said he'd been humiliated. And his secretary said, well, how? And Pope John said when he was humiliated when one of the cardinals, an older man who'd been in the conclave, had to kneel and bow and kiss the papal shoes, which we should explain was the custom at the time, and they had the cross embroidered on them. So you're kissing the cross, not shoes. And so he said, Father Loris, these things, Loris Capovilla, his secretary, these things must change. The church must take a bath of simplicity and humility, and then the light of Christ will shine on the face of the church. And Cardinal Comastri said to Pope Francis, Holy Father, that's what you are doing. Well, I had to stop reading. I was so moved by that. And then I love this, a story you and I know. Francis responded with his own story about Blessed John the 23rd. He told the story of how an ambassador had asked Pope John, how many people work in the Vatican? And the Pope, of course, answered about half. And so...
we come into that half.
Yes. And the Pope told the workers at St. Peter's Basilica, he said, I'm sure you're the half that works. But he did say, I know your colleagues have to be in their offices, so I extend my blessing to them.
Certainly a lovely sense of humor as well, which we saw right from that first meeting with journalists very shortly after his election.
All the spontaneity. And I think, we will not end up having time to go through for his words at all of the liturgies so far. But what has been most moving was Pope Francis's decision on Thursday for the dinner of the Lord's Supper to celebrate it at a juvenile detention center and wash the feet of 12 of the young people at that center. I mean, if you want a total lesson in humility.
This was something he'd been used to doing back in Buenos Aires,
yes,
wasn't it?
Exactly.
Visiting a prison or home for the poor
and
the needy.
Always on Holy Thursday on that second mass of the day. So
he had the chrism mass in the morning in St. Peter's.
And, you know, I have to tell you, just at that mass, you know, they have these beautiful big silver recipients for the oils, which are then distributed and will be used throughout the years. Every single diocese, of course, does this on Holy Thursday at the Chrism Mass. The oils to be used in sacraments, the anointing of the sick, and the ordination of young men to the priesthood and so forth. But I looked at those urns, if you will, and only Francis could make me think of this. I would have never thought of it before. I looked at the silver and I thought, he's a man of such simplicity and wanting to live in Santa Marta instead of the papal apartment. I just looked at the silver and I thought, wow, you know, is Francis thinking what I'm thinking?
Maybe an earthenware pot would be more
appropriate. Yes, exactly. And I never would have thought of that. So he's already created that awareness in our minds. Of the simplicity of the he's going to make the poor, the disadvantaged, the disabled, the handicapped, the marginalized, these are all going to be at the center of his pontificate.
And he spoke very clearly about that in his sermon, in his homily at the Mass, the Chrism Mass too, about the need for priests to go out to the very margins of society.
Exactly. And there's the story, I was told, he also said, you know, if you're a shepherd, you have your flock, and he says, the shepherd should have the same odor, I'm not exactly sure if that's the correct word to use, as his flock. And because you shouldn't be different or superior or above. You know, you have been entrusted with their care. You're their guardian, as parents are of a child. You have to think of it in that sense. So I'm absolutely positive as we go down the road, because this papacy is so new right now, but as we go down the road, we're going to see him, well, all these categories I just mentioned, he's going to not just emphasize them to us, to fellow Catholics, to other Christians, to anybody who will listen. He's going to bring this up with world leaders. You, mark my words, in his first talk to the head of state that will be made public or a new ambassador, he's going to create this awareness in the minds of leaders. So, and not just leaders, bishops, archbishops, cardinals, but world leaders, your secular world leaders. And so it's going to be very interesting to see if there is a change over time in the mindset of world leaders, where they're all talking to each other and all of a sudden they're talking about their country's poor. And you still have to have the rich, because those are the people that do support a lot of the activities that contribute to the poor. And so the Pope hasn't marginalized that group. He's just saying the group that we don't ever think about. We walk by them on the street or something. This is the group that has to be at the center of our attention. So I think in this Holy Week, with all the special things that he's done, and very shortly, actually, as we are recording this, very shortly we'll begin the Stations of the Cross. I'm sure that will be another memorable moment in the papacy of Francis.
Thanks there to our regular guest, Joan Lewis, sharing insights from the events here in the Vatican over Holy Week. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you for listening, and a very blessed and peaceful Easter to all of you from all of us here at Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.